are tuned to Aspen Public Radio, and in just a moment, we will join a conversation with Secretary of State John Kerry. Kerry talks with Aspen Institute President and CEO Walter Isaacson as part of the track Global Affairs, Our Age of Insecurity. You'll be able to hear this discussion later today on our website, and we expect to get started in just a moment here with our live broadcast from the Aspen Ideas Festival.
Thank you very much. It's a great honor and pleasure for us to have a man I've admired, most of us have admired, for many years, a man who U.S. Naval, served in Vietnam, won the Purple Heart, three Purple Hearts, the Bronze Medal, the Silver Medal, has been a senator, candidate for president, and now our Secretary of State. In the past 2.5 days, he started in Rome to meet with Netanyahu and help seal the deal with the Turks. And then, unscheduled, after the Brexit vote, went to Brussels and London, then back to Washington, and then is on to Ottawa tomorrow morning for the summit. So we're deeply grateful that he came and decided to talk to us, the U.S. Secretary of State, 68th Secretary of State, 69 if you count Ben Franklin, 68th Secretary of State of the United States. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you. Well, let me start by apologizing for bringing you into the tent from the outside. I think that's a sin against nature and instinct. Good afternoon to all of you. Walter, where did Walter? You're disappearing. Thank you. Thank you for your warm introduction. Thank you especially for your leadership role here at the Aspen Institute. And I am delighted to be back in Colorado, where I was born about 25 or 35 years ago. It still feels that way, actually, which is good. Frankly, I am at a bit of a disadvantage compared to all of you, because I had to get up early and fly here from Washington, having done a four-country visit yesterday, and instead of partaking in morning yoga. So what can I say? Life is really hard. In fact, I began yesterday morning in Rome with Bibi Netanyahu, where we met. And then I flew to Brussels, where I met with President Juncker and with EU High Representative Mogherini. Then to London in the afternoon, where I met with my counterpart, Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond, and then with Prime Minister Cameron. And then back here, back to Washington, obviously, and now here I am, and I as Walter said, go on to our important North American Leaders Summit tomorrow in Ottawa. But I want to just share with you that genuinely coming to an ideas festival is a treat for me. And I hope we actually can share some ideas and have a little give and take here, which is what is refreshing and timely. And I think that's why you come here. And that's what makes this valuable. After arriving here, I want you to know that I haven't thought once about the alleged scientific evidence that a whole lot of flying shrinks your brain. Some of you may be saying to yourselves, well, that would explain a lot. But I only mention it to establish a very plausible line of defense for when we get the Q&A going on. You have an extraordinary syllabus here. I was looking at it from Obama's foreign policy. I think it's the world according to Obama, the world according to Star Wars, if I recall, Ripple and Einstein's legacy, Mandarin in 60 Minutes, futuristic farming. I mean, you run the list. It's pretty extraordinary, and that's what makes this event both so stimulating and so much fun. But needless to say, I intend to be a little more prosaic, and I hope not pedantic, and talk to you about the world as I see it from my vantage point as Secretary of State, which I've been privileged to do now for 3.5 years. Now, unless you all spent the entire week hiking and sleeping without your cell phone, which is very enticing, believe me. You have undoubtedly been reading, thinking, and talking about Brexit. And maybe in the Q&A we'll talk about it in a little bit. I mentioned I've talked to the leaders from the UK, EU. I left out NATO. I met also with Jens Stoltenberg. And my message to all of them was very simple, that America's commitment to the EU and to Great Britain is as strong as ever to both the transatlantic partnership and to our special relationship. And the Brexit vote, in my judgment, and I think President Obama's judgment, does not affect the agenda that we share with NATO, the G7, the P5, and by the way, the NATO leaders. We will all be meeting in about a week in Warsaw for the NATO summit, and it actually makes that summit more important. It makes much of what we will be doing to reassure the frontline states and to make it clear how important that alliance still remains. So we will continue to collaborate with both the British and the EU. And I want to just emphasize, as I did in England yesterday, the values that we have shared for so long with our friends, the Brits, and that we shared in the vision of an EU, and the interests, and its interests and values that make up foreign policy, and its interests and values that brought us together. They are the same today as they were before the vote last Wednesday. Didn't change a thing. So remember that as we go forward. And I reminded both parties how critical it is to remain steady here. The steadiness of our purpose, I think, is evident and embraced by all. And the ability to rely on capable partners right now in this world that we're living in is more critical than ever, because it is increasingly clear that pundits and practitioners alike understand more and more of how we are living in a much more complex world than at any time in our history. For years, if you go back to the fall of the Berlin Wall and the great changes that came about thereafter, Tito, Yugoslavia, societies were compressed by the Cold War, by the entire post-World War II order. And a lot of societies were shielded by the absence of communication, by the slow pace of doing business, if they did business at all effectively, and by the simplicity of the bipolar East-West divide, which defined the world for the latter part, and even for most of, since 1917, for most of the 20th century. Now, as every single one of you knows, and as you talk about in every which way as we contemplate various disruptors in our lives and in society, we are dealing with a world which speeds up politics, speeds up a flow of information beyond the capacity of most people to digest it. And believe me, that was underscored by the fact that I noticed that the largest internet Google search in England the day after the vote was, "What is the EU?" I'm serious. So this is a world where globalization and instantaneous communication are connecting people in more ways than ever before. You know, the kids in Tahrir Square, that wasn't motivated by any religious extremism, nor were the kids who originally came out in Syria to demonstrate for a future. The fact is that we see more people connected in more ways than ever before, and so everybody knows what everybody else has, and that underscores what you don't have. It facilitates both incredible technological progress, and obviously economic growth that goes with it. I was just in Silicon Valley last week with the various CEOs of major companies there, listening to this discussion about these disruptors, which is fascinating. Any of you in the retail business understand what I'm talking about. But at the same time, there are a whole bunch of folks who believe they've been left behind. And in many places, my friends, they have been. And they're increasingly turning to a narrow-minded tribalism, to aggressive nationalism, and even medieval thinking that reminds us of a very distant and bloody past. So we have no illusion, I certainly have no illusion about the challenges. They are real in this 21st century. And while there are a lot of Cassandras around, I really don't believe the road ahead is defined only by turmoil and strife. After all, it really wasn't long ago that we saw a rapidly expanding nuclear program in Iran, only months away from having enough weapons-grade uranium to build 10 to 12 nuclear weapons. And we were on the cusp of confrontation. Now, because of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Iran's path to actually building a bomb has been closed off. And I say closed off, because you can't build a bomb with 3.67% limit on enrichment and with 300 kilograms of a stockpile. You just can't do it physically. And because we have 130 additional inspectors and all kinds of different ways in which we will know what is going on. By taking away the potential of a nuclear weapon in a country that we still have other issues with, nobody pretends they've been erased, we have changed the strategic equation. Last December, representatives from more than 190 nations came together in Paris to express their commitment to build a new low-carbon energy future for the world in which greenhouse gas emissions are curbed and the worst consequences of climate change are prevented. Last October, after 7 years of negotiation, the United States joined 11 other nations along the Pacific Rim in signing and sending to the Congress the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a trade agreement unlike any trade agreement we've had before. And I, in 28 years in the Senate, voted for all the trade agreements. But this is unlike any of those I voted for, because within the four corners of the agreement, there are labor standards, there are environment standards, and it encompasses nearly 40% of global GDP. It's a game changer. Last August, I had the privilege of traveling to Havana to raise the American flag above our embassy for the first time in 54 years, a change of a policy that has already had a profound impact in the world. And together with a broad array of partners around the world, we have mobilized a coalition to stop the spread of Ebola and save countless lives. And remember, last year, the predictions were by Christmas time, 1 million people were going to die. But President Obama had the courage to send 3,000 American troops, and they had the courage to go and be part of this effort, and we stopped it together with Great Britain and France and the help of other nations around the world. Through PEPFAR and other efforts, we now stand on the brink of the first AIDS-free generation from AIDS. So, ladies and gentlemen, so I just say this to underscore to you that the world is not witnessing global gridlock. We are not frozen in a nightmare. And the facts and the lessons are clear, that where we are engaged with a clear strategy and where we use our power thoughtfully, we are making progress most places. I'm not going to pretend everywhere, and I'll talk about where we aren't. But nobody said things would be easy or that we were going to all get it done all at once. What I find exciting about this moment is that we are staring at extraordinary opportunities everywhere if we look and make the right choices. So don't forget, a lot of people do, our boldest predecessors overcame depression, fascism, two world wars, by singularly focusing on the challenge at hand. But today, as I've described, we face multiple overriding challenges of varying origin that require varying approaches all at the same time. And we're working with countries now, just as an example. We are deeply enmeshed. We have a special envoy that we appointed to work with the government of Colombia to try to achieve a just and lasting peace, a signing just a week or two ago, a few days ago. We hope to have that finished in a matter of a month or two. We've been working with countries to support a new government of national accord in Libya. I was recently in the United Arab Emirates. I think we've come to a common understanding of how to strengthen that government and go after Daesh in Libya. We're supporting Afghanistan and its fight against extremists and to support a sovereign and democratic Ukraine. And so That is why I state unabashedly to every single one of you, the United States of America is more engaged in more places with greater impact today than at any time in America's history. And that is simply documentable and undeniable. Now, this is an ideas festival. And I want to talk to you about what I see after years of being involved in public life, about the problems we face, because I am convinced there are three particular challenges, each of which requires that we show that singularity of purpose and focus that our parents and grandparents did in the course of the last century. And that is to have a intense shared focus. The first is violent extremism and the emergence of radical non-state actors as opposed to state actors, which defined the last century for the most part. I might just comment, I want to make sure publicly that I comment that just today, a bomb went off at the airport in Istanbul. 10 people we know are, according to press reports at least, are dead and some 40 wounded, and we are still collecting information and trying to ascertain what happened and who did it. And I won't comment further on it except to say that this is daily fare. And that's why I say the first challenge we need to face is countering non-state violent actors for a host of reasons. The second is the need, more urgent than ever, and more urgent certainly than some national politicians seem willing to admit, to preserve the health of our planet in the face of imminent climate change, happening climate change, and other environmental dangers. And the third is connected to the other two, and it's part and parcel of how we're going to solve the whole problem. It is a global crisis of governance that will require leaders everywhere to cooperate, fight corruption, earn public confidence, inspire unity, and actually make decisions about issues that are relevant to the people who populate our countries. Now, I hope in the Q&A we'll talk a little more about the climate and the governance, because they're worth some focus. But let me focus for the moment, just in these comments, and then we'll get into the Q&A, about the struggle against violent extremism. Everybody knows the threat. We've all awakened to the news that I've just announced to you. How many times have you awakened to it? Vicious attacks perpetrated by a lone wolf or by a group, inspired on the internet or otherwise, from Orlando to San Bernardino to the Philippines and Bali, we've seen pictures and we've heard testimony of shocking crimes committed by Al-Qaeda, by Boko Haram, by Jaish al-Islam, by Har al-Sham, by Al-Shabaab, Daesh, other groups against innocent civilians, against journalists, and against teachers particularly. And we're all aware that Daesh uses sexual slavery as a recruitment tool, and it pins price tags on little girls to help finance its operations. This is the reward of going to fight. And we've heard Daesh's preposterous boast to be the creator of a new caliphate and the leader of all Islam. So two summers ago, when Daesh began its rampage in Iraq, please remember, we heard dire predictions of a permanent unraveling in the Middle East, the erasure of national boundaries, the prospect that Baghdad itself might fall and come under the sway of the terrorists. At a time when Daesh and its black flags and its 50 caliber mounted Toyotas were careening through Syria and Iraq, and people thought Baghdad might fall, President Obama immediately mobilized our air power, and we moved to save thousands of people at Sinjar Mountain who were about to be slaughtered by Daesh. Then the president directed me to go about and build a coalition, which is now at 66 members, with representatives from across the globe. And we will all be meeting together in Washington in a few weeks, July 21st, to measure our progress. So at this festival of ideas, my idea is frankly pretty straightforward. We have to complete the job. We have to defeat Daesh, its affiliates, and its imitators in Afghanistan, Libya, Nigeria, and elsewhere, wherever they raise their ugly head. And that is not an option, my friends. That is an imperative. It is critical to our national security because we know they're plotting, and we know what they will do to other countries in the region who are our allies and friends and important to the stability of the world. And make no mistake, this is not a clash of civilizations. This is a clash of civilization against a kind of barbarism. Between civilization and medieval and modern fascism wrapped together at the same time. And yes, between a cultural clash with modernity and the failure of governance to do anything for some of these countries over the last 50 years or more. So it will take years of determined effort, but the effort has to be determined. And it'll take sacrifice to succeed. But think back to what I said about the last century and sacrifice. The good news is we have absolutely, certainly, without any doubt whatsoever, started down the right path. Last year at this time, in the core areas of Iraq and Syria, we were containing the terrorists of Daesh. Now we are moving methodically and authoritatively to destroy them, to take back territory, and put Daesh on a definable path to defeat. To date, our coalition has conducted some 13,000 airstrikes. We've taken out more than 120 known, identifiable, high-level leaders, and we have caused the ranks of Daesh to shrink by one-third. Together with our partners, we have pushed Daesh out of nearly half of the populated territory it once controlled in Iraq and about a quarter of the land that it controlled and occupied in Syria. And I am currently involved in discussions with the Russians now to see if we can change the structure of this current ceasefire and actually make progress with respect to taking out all of the terrorists in the country while also trying to find a political solution to the challenge. We have liberated Tikrit, Sinjar, Ramadi, Hasaka, and Kobani. And the Iraqi security forces have just taken back the key city of Fallujah. And local forces in Syria are pressing Daesh in the strategic town of Manbij. And now we understand much better how Daesh operates. We are enabled to adjust our targeting, more effectively hammer its heavy weapons, its training camps, supply routes, its infrastructure. We have destroyed over 400 of its tanker trucks that were taking oil out to Turkey or to Iraq in order to sell it and fund their operations. We have cut their revenue at least in half. And without additional towns to plunder, Daesh has less money to buy weapons or pay its fighters. We're also working diligently to destroy Daesh's narrative, the narrative that they are successful, that they hold territory, they are a state, that they are the caliphate of the future. All of that narrative is what has drawn fighters from France, from Germany, from the United States, from Australia, from around the world. And we are working diligently in a whole counter-narrative strategy together with our friends in the Middle East and elsewhere. So, it has been more than 1 year since Daesh has actually launched a full-scale military offensive. And that's because our coalition is moving forward relentlessly on every front. Now, yes, you can bomb an airport. You can blow yourself up. That's the tragedy. Daesh and others like it know that we have to get it right 24/7, 365. They have to get it right for 10 minutes or 1 hour. So it's a very different scale. And if you're desperate, and if you know you're losing, and you know you want to give up your life, then obviously you can do some harm. So our fight from Daesh in Iraq and Syria is not over. The big tests are still ahead, especially in retaking Mosul, which is the largest remaining stronghold in Iraq, though we have now surrounded it, and we are laying the groundwork for an offensive. And, of course, Raqqa in Syria. And let me be blunt. Taking out Daesh is only one part of this struggle. We have to, as a nation, and particularly a Congress and an executive, come together to engage in a far more comprehensive effort against the forces that make terrorism a global, not just a regional threat. To confront this challenge, I recently created the first Countering Violent Extremism Office at the State Department, and I introduced a new strategy together with President Obama and the strategy the White House is pursuing, all joined together and our Defense Department in order to have one united front to counter this violent extremism. But listen to the words of Henry David Thoreau. A long time ago, he got it right. There are 1,000 hacking at the branches of evil to only one who is striking at the root. Clearly, we have to strike relentlessly at the root causes of violent extremism, or we're going to play extremist whack-a-mole for years to come. And we can't do that unless we first understand those roots. After serving in public life now for over 3 decades, I am aware that there are few more reliable and easy punchlines on the stump when you're running for office than to stand up and promise to slash the budget of the State Department or USAID and just say very simply, we shouldn't be spending money over there on those people, we need to spend it right here in bloop, Iowa, Indiana, Illinois, wherever the hell it is, and everybody erupts in applause. That makes sense. Easiest thing in the world. Good applause line. Lousy policy. Short-sighted, self-inflictive of harm to our own nation. I know in Washington, particularly the Washington of today, that long-term goals can sometimes get really quickly wiped out by visible short-term projects or just short-term responses. But that's exactly why we need to take the long view, and we need to recognize how relatively modest investments now can improve the world enormously and enhance our security for generations to come. My friends, we are the richest economy on the face of this planet. $18 trillion economy. We spend one penny of every single dollar that we spend on all of our foreign aid initiatives, all of our State Department, all of our embassies, everything we do for diplomacy. One penny on the dollar. The richest economy in the world cannot be content to put one penny on the dollar into the effort to protect our nation. And as we've learned in this era, poisonous ideas can come from many places. An inflammatory sermon, a radical teacher, an angry parent, a woman on a website, or a man in the next cell. They might originate with pictures seen on the nightly news, or from perceived acts of discrimination or repression, or from the desire to avenge the death of a loved one. They might grow out of illness, envy, desperation, or personal craving for fame at the cost of self-destruction. So here's the question. How do we help give young people here and across the globe something better to hold on to? The full answer to that, obviously, would require a whole shelf of books, not brief remarks. But the chapter headings might include the following. First, fight corruption, because there is a direct link between corruption and the rise of violent extremism. Nothing does more to undermine respect for the rule of law than the perception that governments consider themselves to be above the law. How astonishing it is that billions of dollars were stolen, maybe $50 billion from the government of Nigeria, maybe $30 billion from the government of Yemen. And that is stealing from the education and the health and the infrastructure and the future of the citizens of those countries. And what about the banks that deposit that money and second it for those who have stolen it? It's a little wonder that there is great unrest in certain parts of the world. And if we're serious about fighting terrorism, then we have to expose corruption and protect whistleblowers and prosecute perpetrators and throw the guilty in jail. And at the same time, we have to strive for improved governance across the board. What does that mean? That means preventing graft, strengthening democratic and accountable governance, where basic freedoms are protected and people have the ability to express their views openly, without harassment and without fear. After all, if citizens are going to respect their governments, then governments need to respect their citizens. Now, second, we have to invest in education. I can't emphasize this enough. Globally, right now, as we sit here in Aspen, in these extraordinary surroundings, 120 million children and adolescents are out of school. We can't settle for a policy, my friends, that plans to get these kids in school in 10 years. You're 10 years old today, 9 years old, 7 years old. You could be 17, 18 before somebody starts to teach you something. They need to go to school now. And we need an emergency global education effort. When I was in Pakistan as a senator, I went up to the area of the earthquake, you remember, a few years ago, up near the mountains of the Himalayas. And I remember these kids who had come down out of the mountains, and they were in a tent with desks and a chair, and they had uniforms somehow that someone had gotten them. And half of these kids were in school for the first time in their life. And why were they there? They were there because of an emergency that brought them there. Well, I'm telling you, I don't think we should wait for a flood or an earthquake. We have an emergency now, and we should treat this as if it were an emergency now and make sure these kids are getting the education that they need. Now, terrorist recruiters are on the prowl. If I were running for office, I'd milk that. I'd try to, well, I'm not. I'm sorry. Terrorist recruiters are literally prowling around. I have a foreign one, I won't tell you which country, but in Africa, my counterpart told me how you grab these kids at age 5 and they pay them and then they proselytize, then they don't need to proselytize because their minds are gone. And they've got them, and then they don't have to pay them. Then they go out and get the next group. And my counterpart, the foreign minister of this country, said to me, you know, they have a plan for 30 years or 35 years. We don't even have a 5-year plan. So think about it. To win the battle of ideas, we have to ensure that kids everywhere actually have schools to go to, that schools don't preach hate and radical views, but they offer an opportunity to prepare for a better life. And guess what? That does take a little bit of money. Not as much as people think, but I'm convinced when you think of the other side on which we wind up paying for all of this, it is far cheaper to do it up front and far more effective in so many different ways. Third thing we need to do is close the gap between what students learn in class and the skills that they'll need in the workplace, in today's workplace. And that means addressing unequal access to unemployment and promoting lifelong learning and on-the-job training, not just in other countries, but also right here at home above all. And we have an effort called Global Connect, which we've started, because we're trying to connect the other 60% of the people in the world who do not have the internet yet and need it. Fourth, we have to give entrepreneurs and small business people everywhere the chance to translate their good new ideas into thriving businesses, because innovation is by far, as I'm sure all of you here know, the primary source of job creation. And that means ending the suffocating stranglehold in some countries of militaries and bureaucracies that suck up the private sector to the detriment of the rest of the citizens in the country or the rest of the legitimate business people. It means opening doors to the full participation by women. And there's literally no way we are going to meet the 21st century expectations with 20th century economic policies or 19th century standards of governance. Finally, we need to draw on the basic ideas that have guided America for centuries. I don't know if you, I'm obsessed by Hamilton and I keep listening to, it's magnificent. And it reminds us about those ideas. And if we are consistent in showing the world what we are for, we will never lack allies in the fight against bigotry and terror. And the reason for that is clear. A group like Daesh, in fact, all of these groups, Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, all of them, they're all the same in this regard. They don't have any room for anyone else, folks. If they're allowed to prevail, it would utterly destroy the human mosaic that has existed in the Middle East for countless generations. It castigates Daesh, castigates Yazidis as devil worshippers. It tells Christians, quote, "We will conquer your Rome, break your crosses, and enslave your women." It says of Shia Muslims, quote, "We have a duty to kill them, fight them, displace them, and cleanse the land of their filth." Obviously, you're here celebrating the best of our country, which is a festival of ideas, where we have every opportunity to share our opinions, discuss alternative policies, explain respectfully while those with whom we disagree are mistaken. And one of the things I've learned after years of public life is there are no end to the tests for our country. The testing is constant. But compared to 1950, when the Aspen Institute was founded, we have tremendous advantages. Since then, through American leadership and the combined efforts of good people across the globe, average life expectancy is up 50%. Infant mortality is down by four-fifths. The number of democracies has nearly quadrupled. The rate of extreme poverty has just this year fallen below 10% for the first time ever. Overall, a child entering the world today is more likely than ever before in history to be born healthy, to have vaccinations, to be adequately fed, to be able to get the necessary education, and more likely to live a long life. So I think we have every reason to be confident in the future, provided we are willing to make the investments that leaders have a responsibility to make, provided we do not allow the passions of the day to turn our heads and leave us fighting with one another, and provided we draw the right lessons from our own past. We also need to believe in basic facts and science. 68 years ago, I close just by sharing with you that 68 years ago this week, the United States and its allies launched Operation Vittles in response to the Soviet blockade of ground routes into the encircled city of West Berlin. If we had done nothing, the city would have fallen into communist hands. But the alternative, supplying 2.5 million people entirely by air, using the very small, slow planes of the era, seemed daunting, impossible. Nothing like it had ever been done before, but Harry Truman made the bold decision that we were going to do it anyway. The Allied pilots were not only American, they were Australian, British, Canadian, French, New Zealanders, South African. And imagine their planes, like a long line of birds lined up across the heavens from one end to the other, flying 1,398 missions on a single day. Their cargo holds piled full of food, medicine, and coal. The Soviets sought desperately to jam the communications, but ultimately, after 320 days of continuous airlifts, they gave in. The crisis was over. The city was saved. Today, we have to act with similar resolve. We have to come to the aid of countries that are on the front lines or the next in lines of the targets of terrorist infiltration. We have to improve governance, fight corruption, promote accountability, respect human rights. We have to teach the skills and create the jobs that will make extremist appeals fall on deaf ears. And we have to innovate and build as if our entire generation and the next generation depend on it, because guess what? They do. And we have to maintain relentless pressure on Daesh and its allies until they are thoroughly defeated, both on the field of battle and in the minds of people everywhere. For these not just to be words, these things I've talked about, we need to get all the institutions of our government pulling together. And above all, we need to protect the security of our country, and as the leader of the free world, live up to our own leadership expectations. Nothing will speak to the current unease more than getting the things done that need to be done. And I promise you that right up until the last day, President Obama and I intend to put our full commitment into doing exactly that. Thank you all very, very much.